I'm trying to get as many people to the lifeboat as possible, but along the way, giving people timely, concise updates on global macro as well. Because while Bitcoin is the apex asset, is the solution for people, companies, sovereigns to insulate themselves from the United States fiscal and monetary spiral, it is also an asset within a universe of other assets.
Welcome to episode 19 of the Idea Exchange podcast. I'm your host, Tyler Cho. So when I was an economics major in college, and soon after a financial analyst at Goldman Sachs, this whole idea of making a living trading stocks was something that I, for quite some time, had hoped I could make a career out of. Ultimately, this is what drew me to the world of investing. This simple idea that one could build a fortune from a small bit of capital. It was like the ultimate magic trick, but much easier said than done. Ever since leaving Goldman a few years ago, my interest in following stocks, the markets, watching CNBC has waned considerably. Nowadays, I am very much a boring ETF investor. And the reason is twofold. On the one hand, I had realized that developing the skill set to outperform the markets requires an incredible amount of dedication and passion. And on the other hand, the cognitive bandwidth that comes with the never-ending and highly distracting information flow on a day-to-day basis, unless it is actually your career, unless you are pursuing this as your profession, the detrimental effects, in my opinion, of constantly being exposed to external information flows that will pull you in one direction and your emotions in the other are, in my opinion, ultimately unhelpful for long-term compounding and success. The one thing, however, that has continued to hold my attention in the area of investing is Bitcoin and the discussions around what money is, who controls it, why currencies have lost so much of their purchasing power in recent decades. These ideas are actually what spurred my first learning sprint on money fundamentals early last year. And that exercise did a few things. It deepened my belief that the US dollar would continue to do a poor job serving as an effective store of value. And it also deepened my belief that despite undertaking this extended study, there was so much more about the financial system, the history of monetary policy, geopolitical dynamics that I really didn't understand. My guest in this episode is Joe Consorti. Joe is a market analyst at the Bitcoin Layer, a research firm covering macroeconomic and market news from a Bitcoin perspective. And Joe is also an advisor to Theia, a Bitcoin self-custody startup. I first came across Joe from a podcast appearance he had in 2022 and was impressed by the quality of his thinking, especially given that he was in his early 20s. In this episode, we talk about Joe's path to Bitcoin, the risks or lack thereof that Bitcoin faces today, recent inflation prints and what that means for future inflation, the upcoming Bitcoin halving, and a lot more. I should preface this episode by saying that none of my conversations should ever be taken as investment advice. While I am bullish on Bitcoin, given the knowledge that I currently possess, I think it's imperative that every investor make their decisions based on their own convictions. With that said, please enjoy my conversation with Joe Consorti. So, Joe, I am excited for this conversation for a couple of reasons. One is I have been following the Bitcoin space for some time via podcasts, books, the markets a little bit as well. And I think it's one thing to digest a bunch of information, but it's another thing to interact with it via conversations and via writing. And so I know I have been following you for a little over a year now, the work that you've been doing over at the Bitcoin Layer and have been sharing on your Twitter. So I'm excited to dive into some of those conversations as well. But separately, I've also been using this podcast as a way to share stories of young people who have kind of manifested careers that they're passionate about. And I think that your work in the Bitcoin space, being as young as you are, is quite interesting. So I guess, first off, appreciate you coming on. And second, as a starting point here for the conversation, could you just maybe share a little bit about your path to finding Bitcoin and ultimately kind of pursuing that as a career path?
Absolutely. Well, thanks, Tyler, for having me on. I'm really excited to talk today. Despite all the scheduling difficulties, happy we were able to make it work. Yeah, so finding Bitcoin, it was an interesting one for me because I didn't want to work in business at all originally. And now I'm not even working, I guess, in business per se. I'm working in writing. And of course, building business is adjacent to that, but a lot of writing and researching. So a lot of dominoes kind of fell in order to get me here. And it really started with, I wanted to go on the pre-med track. I wanted to become a pediatrician because when I was a kid, I had a great deal of surgeries. I was in and out of the emergency room, but I was in and out of surgery for my ears specifically. I'm not hard of hearing anymore, but when I was a kid, it was really tough. And so I wanted to become an ear, nose, and throat surgeon or a pediatrician. So obviously those are kind of disparate, but they're both in the medical realm. That's what I wanted to do. And so I applied to a great deal of schools. I got into some in the Boston area, but none of them gave me very good money. And so I decided to go to UVM because they have a good medical program and also they have a hospital on site. It's the best hospital in Vermont. And so I decided to go there to do the pre-med track. I get there, I decide that I don't want to go into medicine because it was the first time that I actually thought, wait a second, I really don't want to be in school for 12 years. I don't want to do that. And so I switched into business and I decided to pursue finance and economics. I have a double major in that now. And so essentially that's how I ended up doing business. It wasn't a decision that came from nowhere. Obviously the not wanting to do medical school for 12 years was a part of it. The other part of it was in high school, I did this club called DECA, which is a business club. And I was the president of competition prep. And I love talking. And so I wanted to have some kind of career where I get to speak. Granted, the career I'm in now, there's a lot of writing going on. But by the same token, I'm doing a lot of talking. So I'm very happy I was able to be where I'm at. That's why I pursued business initially. And so finance and economics, the reason I did those as opposed to the other careers is because someone who's in finance can go and work in marketing, but not the other way around, right? And so I wanted to make it so that if I was going to be a business major, I was going to be the most specialized business major that you can be. So that way I could wear every single hat, right? Every single hat possible, whatever role I end up in at any company I end up at. And while I was at UVM, they were giving free Bloomberg terminals to students in the library. And so that was something that I was kind of interested in initially. So I went and I signed up and I got an account and it's like, you know, it's like trying to read the Rosetta Stone for the first time. It's trying to decipher another language. It's so tough. And so I really made it a mission to become literate with the Bloomberg terminal just for fun. And as a function of that, I kind of fell in love with markets. I fell in love with understanding the relationship between all these asset classes, correlations, how to invest, what moves the market, what drives the Fed's decisions, things like that. I became interested in these things freshman year of college. We get sent home for COVID, very unfortunate. And that summer, I ran a small painting company down here at home in the greater Boston area. And at the end of the summer, I had a pretty substantial for an 18-year-old amount of capital to deploy somewhere. And my friend Tyler was buzzing in my ear about Bitcoin. Tyler LaRoche, he now works at Bitcoin Inc. He was talking to me about Bitcoin. It was an asset that was kind of on my radar. Earlier in the year, it had crashed from $10,000 to $3,000. So it was kind of on my radar. It was making its way back up. By the time he told me about this, August, September, October, it was about $8,000, $9,000. So I deployed all the capital that I had earned from the previous summer that was left, that I hadn't blown on other things left, into Bitcoin. Great decision, because obviously in the from December of 2020 or October of 2020 all the way through 2021, right? Late 2021, we had that huge bull market. So that was a great decision at the time. And what really enamored me with Bitcoin was the two articles he sent me in order to understand what it was beyond its superior monetary properties, which were, beyond its superior, risk-adjusted returns compared to other assets, were the Bullish Case for Bitcoin by Vijay Boyapati and The Masters and Slaves of Money by Robert Breedlove. And those two those two essays, books, they really got me interested in sort of the Austrian side of things and the monetary properties of Bitcoin, right? Beyond this high beta tech stock, what's the utility of this? And really, from that point until today, my entire investing framework, my entire markets analysis framework is kind of centered around the problem of our generation, which is the wealth problem. The United States is in a situation where the fiscal train is coming off the tracks. The CBO projects debt to GDP to be 200% by 2040. At our current pace, we're going to get there well before that. And we're running historic deficits in order to prop the economy up. And so we're in a spot where record debt issuance needs to keep happening. Debt issuance that we've never had outside of crises like COVID and like an actual recession, in order to just maintain the positive 2% quarter over quarter GDP growth that we've always had. And so we're in a situation where debt is becoming incrementally less effective. As a result of that, more of it has to get issued, but the market can only buy so much. So the Fed has to monetize the rest. And where does the Fed get the money from to do that? Prints it out of thin air. And so in this situation, the only ways out of it, right, are to be austere. And that would mean raising taxes and cutting spending, which would mean no politician on the Hill would ever get elected again, or lie to the American people, continue running these record deficits, and allow price inflation to nominally erode the value of the U.S. government's debt over the next 50, 60, 70 years, while holders of the U.S. dollar get pillaged in the process. And really, option two is the option they're going for. We've seen it in their behavior over the last 5 years. So with that in mind, Bitcoin doesn't just become a superior asset from a risk-adjusted returns perspective. It becomes basically the only thing that you want to hold in this kind of environment because you can't make more of it. And so that's what really I've been working on over these last 3 years since I started working with Nick and now more recently with Smeet and the team over at Theia Bitcoin, which is a self-custody software wallet for free on the App Store. And essentially that's the message I'm trying to spread. I'm trying to get as many people to the lifeboat as possible, but along the way, giving people timely, concise updates on global macro as well. Because while Bitcoin, you know, is the apex asset, in my view, it is the solution for people, companies, sovereigns to insulate themselves from the United States fiscal and monetary spiral, it is also an asset within a universe of other assets. And so for that reason, it's important for me to be well-rounded and not sensationalist and talk about the entire global macro picture rather than just Bitcoin as an asset. So I went on a bit of a tear there, but that's basically how I went from wanting to go into ear, nose, and throat to ending up where I am today.
In terms of the early years in undergrad, so I had studied economics as well, but in terms of the types of macroeconomic teachings that they typically espouse in traditional textbooks, a lot of this doesn't get into a lot of, let's say, the fundamental Bitcoin advantages. Like, that is not made clear in most economic coursework. I'm curious, in terms of after your friend Tyler had shared those two articles with you, was it a fairly easy decision just to get on board, or was there a bit of a rationalization process or exercise that you had to go through? I'm just curious because when I was an undergrad student, I had come across a few Bitcoin podcasts. I was initially a bit skeptical because the whole crypto space was muddied with, I guess what you would call like Bitcoin, which is a pretty fundamental, hard, really asset. But then there's a bunch of other crypto projects. And so it was a little bit difficult as an outsider who hadn't done deep research, being able to dissect what is legitimate and what was not. So I'm curious how long that process kind of took and if it was fairly intuitive early on about Bitcoin and the bullish case for it.
For sure. Yeah, so I will say that initially when I did get into Bitcoin, I was leaning on my friends Tyler's intuition quite a bit. Him and I are really good friends. We were really great friends during freshman year. And, you know, we still are to this day. So I was really, and again, I had just come off a summer where I was taking boatloads amount of risk with my own time and capital. And so this was, you know, just another natural extension of that. And it's something that I still espouse to today, taking an outsized amount of risk every single day and all your endeavors, everything that you do as young as possible, very important stuff. And so that's kind of, you know, that was certainly a part of it. I definitely didn't go on a deep dive. I did, the extent of my research prior to me investing in Bitcoin was trying to figure out the difference between Bitcoin and all the other stuff. And pretty early on, it was made apparent to me that everything else, not basically everything else. There is a company behind it. There's a central entity behind it. And the rule set can be changed by that central entity in some way. Bitcoin is the only one where the rule set is programmatically ingrained, and it's upheld by tens of thousands that we know of, more likely hundreds of thousands, running anonymously, individual computers all around the world. And so if this thing is absolutely scarce, and if that absolute scarcity is absolutely guaranteed, okay, realistically, because of Bitcoin's decentralization, then that's the only one I want to touch, right? The reason we're in the situation we are now is because of the central manipulation of the price of money. The reason we're in the situation we're in now is because of the Federal Reserve. I don't want to recreate a central bank. I don't want any central entity to be responsible for my monetary policy. And that's a lot of what I see at all these other affinity scam, shitcoin bucket shops, pardon my French. And so really early on, that was the approach I took with Bitcoin. Thankfully so, because I know a lot of people went down the rabbit hole of wanting, they want that beta. That beta is beautiful. That's why people are getting into Bitcoin, because Bitcoin is beta to the stock market. If you own, in your 60-40 portfolio, buy 5% of Bitcoin, it's going to represent 30-40% of your investment returns that year. Excellent. But also people who are in Bitcoin, they want beta too, right? They see the price action. It's boring. They want to invest in a micro cap. I understand. So thankfully, I didn't go down that route, because I came from it. I think a great deal of this too. I came from a great deal of skepticism toward higher authority. And that skepticism toward higher authority came from when they sent us home. I wish I could say that I had it much earlier in life, but this came from when they sent us home during COVID. They said initially it was spring break. I took an overnight bag, basically no clothes in it. And then they wouldn't let us come back to the dorms to get everything until June. So I was stuck for 3 months with this overnight bag. Nobody was allowed back in the dorms. It was really silly and totalitarian. And from that kind of day forward, I was, very, very jaded toward central authority. And that's not to say that, it's a punk rock thing to be, whatever, but just this general level of skepticism had been growing and growing and growing. And it also, it fit very nicely with what I had been researching with the terminal, understanding the Fed's reaction functions and how the Fed, this central entity, is responsible for the boom and bust cycle. It's responsible for the engineering of the mass asset price appreciation, then the collapse that follows and the asset price appreciation. That has created the biggest problem of our generation, like I said, which is the wealth problem. And so it kind of all clicked. Bitcoin as an asset kind of all clicked because of the year that it was, the experience that I had, but also the reality of, the Federal Reserve being this huge problem. So thankfully, going into Bitcoin, I had this huge, healthy level of skepticism. So seeing Bitcoin as the only asset, the only network that's sufficiently distributed in order to maintain its rule set, that's thankfully the reason that I only invested in Bitcoin, and still to this day have only and will ever only advise people to invest in Bitcoin. Of course, not financial advice.
Of course, it's one thing to find an interesting asset, allocate your assets to an investment in that space, and I enjoy the rewards from that decision. I think maybe it's another thing to decide to kind of tie your future career to it. How quickly did you realize, like, hey, Bitcoin is interesting for its properties and maybe other values, I guess, around the asset class that people within the community appreciate and value? Like, how quickly was it obvious to you, hey, this is a career path that I want to pursue as well?
That's a really good question. During the year 2021, I decided to take the entire year digital. UVM was offering that. And, my goodness, if I can pile on the credits while I'm sitting at my desk at my house, I don't have to pay for a dorm room. That's perfect. Yeah. Right? And so that's what I decided to do. I decided to pile on the credits and I decided to stay at home. And during that time, I really delved deeply into doing markets research. I had plenty more time to be doing it, but also I didn't really have an outlet for it. And so Twitter became kind of my outlet of sorts. And the analogy I give for Twitter is it's a living blog. It's a living blog. If you want to land a job in any industry, focus solely in on that industry, get obsessed with it, become very, very good at articulating your thoughts on it however you can add value, and then tweet about it. And so that's really what I was doing with Bitcoin. I was striking all these charts and analyzing all these things and I had all these thoughts. Granted, in hindsight, a lot of them are, you know, a lot of them may be a little embarrassing to me today, but that's really where I started, right? Is kind of tweeting out into the void and building an audience that way. Of course, a great deal of commenting under other people's posts, but it really was just kind of this release valve for all this time I had on my hands and all this work that I was doing. And it wasn't until I started really getting, I still have a relatively, you know, very, very small account comparatively to all the other analysts on Twitter. But it wasn't until I started regularly getting engagement and getting people commenting that I figured that, you know, maybe this could be a career path for me. And what really sealed the deal was I flew myself out to the Bitcoin conference in 2022 to speak with companies, to just go from booth to booth and talk to people. And Tyler LaRoche, the same friend who introduced me to Bitcoin, also introduced me to a gentleman by the name of Matt Snow, who is a general partner today at Trammell Venture Partners. They're a Bitcoin native venture capital firm based in Austin, Texas. They do excellent work. And Matt Snow has become an excellent friend since him and I were introduced. And he paired me up with Nick Bhatia. Nick Bhatia at the time in the spring of 2022 was looking for a research associate, somebody who could help Nick scale the Bitcoin layer, because Nick began the Bitcoin layer in September 2022 as the sequel to his book Layered Money, which is on my shelf. It's out of frame. I should reposition this camera one of these days so it's actually facing that wall with all the books I have on it. But author of Layered Money, he basically wanted to make TBL as the sequel of sorts to his book. He didn't want to necessarily write another book, which he's actually writing another book now. It doesn't have anything to do with Bitcoin, but he's writing another book now, and he wanted to use TBL as kind of his outlet to do live markets research, his thoughts that, you know, didn't need to be released in book form. They could be released immediately to anybody who wanted to read them. And in order to scale something like that, you need somebody to help you up your content. And at the time, I was about to graduate a year early because I had done this year online. Fast forward to 2022, I did the next year in person, but I had decided to keep up the pace of credits. Why not? You know, I really only had about like a semester and some change of the college experience. Then we all got sent home, and then I took the year off, and then I came back, and I decided, okay, I could either spend another year and a half here, or I could really pursue Bitcoin. I could dive head first. I could do this. And so really, I credit what I'm doing today to Matt Snow, because he introduced me to Nick Bhatia. Nick Bhatia and I got on a phone call. We had a couple of phone calls, and I've been working with him since May of 2022. So we're coming up on our second year of building out TBL, and we've grown the Bitcoin layer from a Substack publication that had 4,000 or 5,000 subscribers to a publication, a syndicated multimedia Bitcoin and global macro research firm that is not just on Substack, but it's syndicated. We have a YouTube show now that also is syndicated across all podcast platforms that has an audience of 17,000 subscribers, I believe. So really, we are hitting the ground running. We've had tremendous growth, and I credit all of it to Matt Snow. And so there wasn't necessarily a moment. It just happened to be what I was doing and what I was interested in. And I never wanted to, and that's not to say I will, right? Maybe Bitcoin fails tomorrow and I have to go get a real job somewhere. But I never wanted to be in a situation where I'm working for somebody in something that's totally soul-sucking. If I'm going to be working, you know, full-time and have my wits about me, I want to be actively involved in building something and building a company. And so with the Bitcoin layer, and since the Bitcoin layer, I've also joined the team at Theia. Really, I wake up every day and I love my job because I am on the ground floor of both of these companies. Theia is a very, very new Bitcoin startup, less than 2 years old. The Bitcoin layer is just over 2 years old. And so really, you know, of course, you know, there's a great deal more work involved in what I'm doing, but it is so much more fulfilling because this is the ground level. The dopamine release that you receive in building a company versus working for somebody is totally incomparable, totally night and day. So that's kind of that's how I got into working in Bitcoin. It was really just what I was doing at the time, and it just so happened that there was a market for that. I was talking about markets and there are a lot of people that want to know what's going on. And so it's great. I wake up every day. My job involves opening the Bloomberg terminal, reading the tape, understanding what's going on. And I could go out and I could become a trader on a bond desk somewhere. But I'd probably lose my hair very quickly, faster than I already am. But instead, I'm very grateful each and every day to be able to synthesize what's happening in markets and deliver it to both readers and viewers for the Bitcoin layer, and now most recently for Theia Bitcoin as well.
I'm curious to get your take because, as you mentioned, like, yes, you have been on the ground floor as it relates to companies around Bitcoin and just following the markets. I haven't been. I've been an active listener from afar of key people that I respect. And a year ago, I kind of undertook a personal study of reading 10 to 15 books, the Bitcoin layer being one of them, and then, you know, a couple others like David Graeber's Debt, The First 5,000 Years, and SAFE's, you know, The Bitcoin Standard and the Fiat Standard, and, you know, really enjoyed those studies. I guess one thing that I'm curious about is in terms of timing and development. So I guess if you were to look at your 5 years prior self, first having gotten introduced to Bitcoin, and your expectations looking ahead of where Bitcoin's price would be, what the infrastructure around it in terms of other startups and services being developed around Bitcoin, are we further along? Are we less far along than you would have expected? Were there any major surprises, I guess, over the last 5 years from your perspective, just being on the ground floor?
We are further along than I would have expected, and I'm very happy about that. The biggest hurdle today with Bitcoin is on-ramps. It's on-ramps. On-ramps from the perspective of buying Bitcoin and on-ramps from the perspective of being able to custody it. If we are to use Bitcoin the way it was intended to be used, which is a bearer asset, right? We hold the asset, not a custodian on behalf of us, as a bearer asset, then we need to buy it from an exchange and then transfer it to a wallet, okay? And you lose people as soon as you say the word transfer. Buying it from an exchange is already a big enough hurdle. People may have a brokerage account. People may have a tax-deferred savings account. Most people do. But you can't buy Bitcoin in a tax-deferred savings account. You can buy an ETF now, but you couldn't for the longest time. But you can't buy Bitcoin and use it the way it was intended to be used through most major on-ramps. Since I started working in Bitcoin, which again is really, really recently, we've had Swan come into the fold majorly. We've had River, which personally is my favorite Bitcoin company, one of my favorite Bitcoin companies, my favorite way to purchase Bitcoin. They have grown tremendously. It's inexplicable to say how much they've grown. They're a Bitcoin-only exchange. They have their own proprietary multi-sig solution. They make it easier than anybody than any other exchange to withdraw into self-custody and use Bitcoin the way it was meant to be used. Basically, the way I like to describe, and there's also Foundation Devices, which is an extremely simple hardware wallet. Most recently, there's Theia, which it simplifies the hardest part of Bitcoin self-custody, which is what happens to you when you're gone, what happens to your Bitcoin when you're gone. Not just inheritance, but also multi-sig, right? And these things are, you know, 5 years ago, you would need to spend hours and hours and hours figuring what on earth to do with your Bitcoin, right? You recognize all these problems, you go down the rabbit hole, all of a sudden you realize you need to buy a bunch of Bitcoin, but there isn't an easy way to do it and then transfer it off an exchange and use it the way it was intended to be used. But now all of these companies are coming into the fold. In less than an hour, you can set up an account with River, you can buy Bitcoin, you can download Theia on your phone, transfer it to set up a multi-sig vault, transfer it to your multi-sig vault, set up your inheritance plan, and you're golden. You can do all that in less than an hour, okay? You couldn't have done that 5 years ago, or at the very least 5 years ago, you would need much more experience, much more money too. That's another huge barrier to entry, particularly for multi-sig that has been broken by the companies that I just mentioned in the last 5 years. So I'm extremely impressed and I'm very optimistic with where we're headed in terms of Bitcoin development. And the big key thing continues to be on-ramps. If we are going to use Bitcoin as this huge life raft for humanity, for anybody, not everyone, but anybody who cares to learn about it and jump aboard, the biggest issue The biggest issue today is on-ramps, and we need to continue building and scaling on-ramps at the same pace that the Federal Reserve and U.S. Treasury are devaluing the money, right? And we're on course for 200% debt to GDP within the next 10 years or less, frankly. That's extremely disconcerting. Our debt is becoming incrementally less useful. The Federal Reserve has to monetize increasing amounts of it. And so more money than ever is being printed out of nowhere. We got to bring people into the fold. The way to do that is on-ramps. And so in a very roundabout way to answer your question, I'm extremely impressed by the development of the Bitcoin ecosystem. And granted, largely I'm an outside observer. I have nothing to do with the development of these things, but I'm very happy to be on the team over at Theia and obviously working with the Bitcoin layer. My job largely is to educate people on the problem and then relentlessly point them to the solution and how they can insulate themselves.
I want to ask, I guess, from a very high level in terms of risks. I think a lot of the people that I follow in the Bitcoin space have a consensus view around Bitcoin kind of being inevitable. I'm curious from your perspective, in terms of major risks that are possible that could derail Bitcoin as a store of value moving forward, to the point where people were to stop using Bitcoin altogether. Is that even in the realm of possibility from your perspective? If not, are there other foreseeable, like, big risks that you think could slow down the development of a lot of kind of what you had shared earlier in terms of on-ramp solutions and infrastructure and all of that?
The thing that could derail Bitcoin as a store of value is if the people in Washington, D.C. decided tomorrow that they were going to cut spending and raise taxes at the same time during an election year. That's what would make Bitcoin worthless. Bitcoin's value proposition is as long as the government fails to be austere, it goes up in price. It's the most valuable value proposition of the 21st century for that very reason, because the problem is an absolute certainty and the inevitability of this getting worse is also an absolute certainty, because you have to consider the alternative. The alternative is that these politicians all, you know, They get hunted down. They never get reelected again, because at the end of the day, politics is all about spending money on your constituents. And how on earth are you going to do that if you cut spending and raise taxes? You won't. You'll also plunge the U.S. into a multi-year recession, decades-long recession, even if you were to do this. And so it becomes a balance between solving the monetary and fiscal problem, right? Reducing the money supply and inducing a huge deflationary impulse all across the economy. Granted, that would make things more affordable, but we live in a credit-based monetary system where the price of goods needs to go up by 2% a year per what the Fed is, you know, the Fed's mandate. And so where we're headed is an absolute certainty. Prices have risen 20 times or more in the last 60 years. Wages have risen less than half that. And it's not something that's going to get fixed at the highest level. It's on us at the individual level to insulate ourselves from that. And because Bitcoin is absolutely scarce, it offers the best medium to do that, to insulate yourself. And it's also infinitely divisible as well. So the barrier to entry, I say near infinitely divisible, okay? Divisible into 100 million individual units per Bitcoin. And so I don't view any risks to Bitcoin as an asset, as a store of value, because of the situation we're facing in this country and in every country globally. It's bad here. It's even worse in other countries that have a lower position on the global monetary hierarchy. What we're experiencing here in terms of price inflation and runaway fiscal spending and fiscal deficits, it's 10 times worse in basically every Central and South American country. It's 5 times worse in every European country. It's horrible in China. It's horrible in Japan. This is a global issue. This is a global issue. This is the great experiment that's fortunately, lasted about a century. And in the last half century, of course, we've abandoned all notion of being tied to physical reality. We detached money from physical reality in 1971. Now, at the individual level, you can reattach it. You can reattach it. If you price everything in Bitcoin, you're pricing things accurately, because we're talking, I don't know where you're at in the country, but we're thousands of miles from one another. Okay. Oh, you're, I know where you are. You're in Chicago, thousands of miles from one another. The deflationary revolution of technology, you know, it's incredible. And so the price of goods, the price of services should be going down. But because we live in a global credit-based monetary order, we've needed to inject more and more and more money into the system in order to maintain that 2% rate of inflation, right? And if we have deflation, then unfortunately credit completely collapses, okay? So in order to keep this train running, in order to lubricate the gears, per se, it needs to continue, and it needs to continue accelerating because it has to counteract the deflationary forces of technology. The natural order of things is for prices to decrease as we become more productive, for abundance to become more normal. And on the other side of that, you have a you have the Federal Reserve and other global central banks that are seeking to counteract that entirely. And so it's not something that's going to get fixed. So that's why the value proposition of Bitcoin is so high. It's so valuable, such a valuable asset because of what we're faced with. Material risks to Bitcoin from the network perspective are also kind of null and void, okay? We've seen what happens when a country tries to abandon Bitcoin. They try to ban it. Not only has it not worked in China, there's still miners operating in China. People still own Bitcoin in China. It just drives the development of Bitcoin elsewhere. It drives the capital allocators elsewhere. And ultimately, Bitcoin businesses, Bitcoin mining companies, these are going to be some of the most valuable businesses over the next 10, 20, half century, century. And so really, it only does the country horribly in the long run. It drives away capital allocators if you ban Bitcoin, and it doesn't work because at the end of the day, you ban nodes here, more nodes are coming onto the network elsewhere. There'd have to be a coordinated effort globally to shut off all these computers, right? And that's not happening. You could shut half of them off, and then we'd get a difficulty adjustment, and we'd be all right again. You could shut half the miners off, we get a difficulty adjustment, and we'd be right on track once again. You could shut half the nodes off, and we'd still be able to maintain consensus over Bitcoin's monetary policy. It is it's such a brilliant technology and how anti-fragile it is, right? You know, this is something where literally if you try to kill it, it gets stronger. We've never had something like that before. And so geopolitically, I think it'll benefit countries greatly to have a Bitcoin policy framework outlined that they stick to in order to make themselves more attractive on the global stage for global investment. This is basic international finance, trade flows. The countries that don't, you know, they'll be left behind. Obviously, Bitcoin represents a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of economic development today. But in the future, I have a feeling it'll represent far more than that. And I have a feeling more nation states are not just going to want to foster an environment that drives Bitcoin capital allocators in, but they themselves are going to want to hold some of the Bitcoin too. Okay, so the material risks facing Bitcoin from an asset perspective, they're very, very, very few. And from a technology perspective, they're also very few. I view this as an inevitability, and that's not something that I say very lightly. I mentioned earlier, I don't like to be a sensationalist. I like to weigh things with a very, very measured approach. But from my perspective, where the United States is headed from a currency perspective, Bitcoin as an asset, these two things are an inevitability. And so it's kind of beautiful. You have a yin and a yang, and it's ultimately up to the individual to recognize that and get on board.
Do you think that it's possible that the U.S. government is privately accumulating Bitcoin? And I ask because there are smart people within the government, and I think they probably do see the problem for what it is, namely that we are inundated with debt, that the political system incentivizes short-term actions that in the long term inflict self-harm, and that we can't really escape that whole problem. But I'm sure that there are people who treat Bitcoin seriously within the governmental realm. Do you think that is a possibility that the government is accumulating Bitcoin privately?
It's a possibility. I don't think the U.S. government's doing it. They already hold about 1% of the outstanding supply, roughly. This country, the United States, and so obviously from seizing the assets of various criminal organizations and other things that have gone up in smoke over the last several years. And they have begun, as of recently, moving around that Bitcoin. They moved in late 2022. They seized 50,000 Bitcoin from the Silk Road. Last year, or 2 years ago, rather, they held a total of like 70,000 Bitcoin. And so they own a great deal of Bitcoin already. I don't know if they're accumulating it, but they moved $2 billion worth of Bitcoin just last week. And I have a feeling that's probably a test to actually get rid of it. I think they're going to get rid of it for US dollars, because you can't pay the interest payments on your debt in Bitcoin, unfortunately, on the government debt. And right now, annual interest payments are $1.1 trillion, and they're going to be $1.5 trillion by the end of the year with our current fiscal year 2024 and 2025 funding needs and with rates where they are. For context, 7 years ago, annual interest payments on the U.S. government's marketable debt, its U.S. treasuries that it issues, was less than $500 billion. In 7 years, it is more than doubled to $1.1 trillion, and it's going to rise another 50% up to $1.5, $1.6 trillion this year. So it's a huge, they need all the dollars they can get, okay? They don't want the Fed monetizing this stuff with money they print out of thin air. That's going to happen. It's going to have to happen. The Fed will have to step in to support financial stability at some point. We had a really bad, we're having pretty bad auctions right now. You know, demand is, excuse me, it's not drying up in the U.S. Treasury market, but this year, I know, the Fed is going to have to step in and monetize. So the U.S. government is holding Bitcoin, but I have a feeling it's going to sell it, and it may sell it all because it needs dollars desperately from anywhere it can get it in order to fund its interest payment. So I think for now, I don't think the U.S. government is privately accumulating Bitcoin. I think other smaller nation states, they are, in order to insulate themselves from our fiscal and monetary antics. Maybe one day, though. Maybe one day they'll come around. But again, that would involve being austere at the government level, which is a total impossibility. You'll see pigs fly before we're austere at the government level.
I guess part of where the question is going is we have seen kind of time and time again, when there is global conflict, the ability for a government to print money and devalue the currency and use it on, let's say, like wartime spending is a common trend. And no doubt, I believe that that is an incredible exercise of theft, effectively, on the citizenry. But at the same time, it does give that central authority a great deal of power. And so part of where the question is going is, like, what would a Bitcoin-centric world look like in terms of what type of power the U.S. government would have in that ecosystem? And it seems like it would be losing a great deal of it. Is that a fair, I guess, arrow that I'm drawing in terms of where we would be going?
That's a very fair assessment. Yeah, no, it definitely dematerializes a lot of the power that countries have globally. I mean, the United States war machine has been one of the biggest reasons that we have wielded power over smaller nations for ages. And it's only enabled because we totally lucked out at Bretton Woods in 45 or 46. Post-World War II was the biggest economic boom in recorded history. We've experienced globalization. We never had that before. This hat that I have in front of me, this is for another business that I run personally, something that has nothing to do with Bitcoin. It's from China. I had this hat these hats manufactured in China, sent over here. If I told my ancestors that 100 years ago, they would have said, "What on earth are you talking about? What do you mean you ordered it from China and it arrived at your doorstep? And you did it because it was cheaper than making it here. It arrived in your door at your doorstep 30 days after you commissioned it. What are you talking about?" But that's the reality we live in. The United States totally lucked out in Bretton Woods because we positioned ourselves at the center of the last 60 years of global economic development. So now the U.S. dollar underlies the entire framework of currency relations, of trade relations between businesses. It is the primary asset that people hold in order to do their business. And so it's not something that you can unplug and plug back in. Right? A lot of people have been pointing to other currencies and saying that, you know, they're going to take on the role of the US dollar. They're going to assume the hegemony that the US dollar has. It's a total impossibility because, like I said, it's not something you can unplug and plug back in. The United States dollar is entrenched on the balance sheets of every player that's worth their salt globally, okay? I do think that Bitcoin as a digital commodity is going to dematerialize a lot of that power that the United States has over other countries. The United States will continue being the most powerful nation as a result of its current position in the global monetary hierarchy. But over time, it's going to wane more and more and more and more and more as more people are holding and transacting in Bitcoin at an individual level. If fewer people are using dollars, fewer people are holding dollars and transacting in dollars, it makes it much more difficult for the U.S. Treasury to fund itself. If fewer people are buying, there's a less liquid market for U.S. Treasuries, then more of them have to be issued. They have to be issued at a higher interest rate, and it only exacerbates the current fiscal problem that we're experiencing. And so it does take away a lot of the power that the United States currently has in terms of geopolitical power across the world that it kind of wields over people. So Bitcoin definitely will dematerialize a great deal of that power, but the United States will remain the global superpower, in my opinion.
And when it comes to the two kind of core principles, two of the core principles of money, of medium exchange and store of value, in terms of global currencies, the U.S. dollar and others, do you still see a role for those currencies to play in serving as mediums of exchange while Bitcoin serves as a primary store of value? Or do you think that if Bitcoin kind of wins out as a store of value, that we would see global adoption of Bitcoin also as a medium of exchange just on other layers?
Yeah, so there's always going to be credit. And as long as there's credit, you're going to want to use it. Okay, leveraging credit is something that a lot of people are afraid of, but countries and businesses are not afraid of it at all. I think that's one thing at the individual level that many people need to get over is this fear of credit. It's the world that we live in. It is how the world economic machine turns. So I think as Bitcoin continues to win out as a store of value, as more people see it's a superior asset for its monetary properties, but also just on a pure returns, from a pure returns perspective, amidst all of what's going on here, if you run an analysis year to date, it is the best, absolutely returning asset and the best asset for risk adjusted returns year to date. So, as Bitcoin wins out in the store of value, it doesn't necessarily win out in the medium of exchange. It becomes a question of efficiency. What's the most efficient? Right now, Bitcoin isn't the most efficient. Scaling solutions on top of Bitcoin, like the Lightning Network, need to be greatly expanded and invested in order for Bitcoin to become the preferred medium of exchange. Right now, there are a lot of platforms that use Bitcoin as collateral. There's Bitcoin-backed lending on platforms like Ledin. I know Unchained does Bitcoin collateralized lending. But right now, the U.S. dollar is probably going to continue assuming that role, even as Bitcoin surpasses the market cap of gold at like $10 trillion, U.S. Treasuries at $25 trillion. I don't think Bitcoin will take its role as a medium of exchange. Right now, it's totally winning the day when it comes to store of value. But the Lightning Network and also Bitcoin-backed lending systems need to be built up a lot more. And so at the start of this conversation, we talked about infrastructure surrounding buying Bitcoin and then removing it from an exchange. There is still a lot to be desired from the standpoint of Bitcoin adopting those credit properties and having things built on top of it that have to do with credit that would let it become a superior medium of exchange. So that's a really good question, because Nick's book, Layered Money, goes into this in great detail. And in order for Bitcoin to be the asset of the future, there need to be functional credit markets on top of Bitcoin. That's something we don't have yet. And so we have credit markets, but they're not nearly big enough or liquid enough, and the infrastructure isn't there in order for them to assume the role or grow into the role that the US dollar and other fiats currently occupy. So I don't think that as Bitcoin grows into the best store of value, it is, but as it grows larger, I don't think that it becomes a better medium of exchange because of that. That development has to occur right now, and it has to occur in earnest. People have to be sprinting to make Bitcoin a more efficient store of value. Otherwise, credit systems will occur elsewhere. And then the banks still have a great deal of power because as long as people are, you know, credit is denominated in US dollars, banks still have a great deal of power, right? So I think the two are separate. In order for Bitcoin to become the preferred medium of exchange, great deal of investment in the infrastructure for functional, deeply liquid credit markets need to happen. And when they do happen, as they do happen, it'll become an asset that is more common on the balance sheets of these big global players, whether you're talking about businesses or sovereign countries. But in order for that to happen, we need the infrastructure. That's something we're desperately lacking.
Would be curious to pick your brain a little bit in terms of how the U.S. government is trying to ameliorate or, I guess, make less bad the situation that is upon them, and specifically when it comes to like government reports that they put out, either related to inflation, CPI, or as it relates to job numbers. I know that you have written about this in recent weeks, and would just be curious about how what maybe seems on the surface as I guess, factual reporting on the government's behalf. There's a lot more under the iceberg on both of those topics, CPI and like non-farm payroll reports. Could you share a little bit in terms of recent developments there?
Oh yeah, plenty to discuss. So, oh my goodness. So all they have left is propaganda. That's what I'll preface it with. All they have left is propaganda. When I say they, I mean the BLS, the United States government, any other reporting agency that does these economic data releases, because what you've seen is a systemic over-reporting of economic strength followed by a quiet revision the month later when they think that nobody's looking. And it's a huge problem because at the end of the day, low information people, the majority of the voting populace here in the United States, I hate to say it. I don't hate to say it. It's a reality. They will see the initial news chyron of the United States added 250,000 jobs in the month of March. And they'll go, oh my goodness, look at rip-roaring economic strength. But then the asterisk is that last month's payroll was revised down by 190,000 jobs. So wait a second. And this has happened systemically. 10 of the last 12 months, non-farm payrolls reports were revised down after the fact. Not just minorly revised down by tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of positions. This historically happens in the lead up to recessions, but usually it's not as systemic as it is now. And in order for it to be this systemic, they have to be lying. It's actually completely impossible for these reports to be as wrong as they are. One tweet here that I have, this was completely insane. On the Bloomberg terminal, there's a function called Economist Estimates, and I really like it because it takes the estimates of all the economic data prints, non-farm payrolls, other job data, things like that, any economic data release you could think of, CPI, and it basically plots all of the Economist estimates and it puts them on a standard distribution. And for the last 3 months, all three of this year's non-farm payroll reports had job growth that was higher than the highest estimate on Wall Street. That's statistically impossible. It's statistically impossible. In January, there was a four sigma beat, which is completely, I mean, it's the 99.999999 infinity times percentile. That's the report that came in. But then it was revised down lower and it ended up being, you know, in the realm of like the mean of what economists were expecting. So they're lying. They're not doing this out of lack of information. They have plenty of information. They're doing this deliberately. It's not as if they're getting these numbers wrong because it's an honest mistake. Given what's happened, not just over the last 12 months, but these three reports in particular, it's so staggering, it's statistically impossible. These numbers are being cooked. They're lying to you. All that they have left is propaganda, okay? Consistently deviating this far above the mean, at the same time that consumer surveys are painting the polar opposite picture of the job market, they're lying to you. It's a clear manipulation of the headline data in order to get those initial news chyrons and then quietly revising it down a month later when no one cares, right? Because when you get the news chyron that says 250,000 jobs added in the month of March, then the Biden administration, or whoever's in office, not just a blue or red thing, they can go out and feign this economic strength. They could say, look how mighty the United States is. What recession? What are you talking about? But then you talk to everyone you know, and you also look at consumer surveys from the University of Michigan, and it's not good. Affordability is at an all-time low for housing because of where prices are, where interest rates are. The amount of times that people have been rejected from jobs for their qualifications is at an all-time high. People not only can't find jobs after they leave them, after they're fired, but new jobs are being created at such a low rate that having one full-time job and holding on to it is totally a thing of the past. So the BLS is painting, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, is painting this picture of the U.S. economy where it's all rosy, it's all fine and dandy, everyone's doing really well, but the reality couldn't be further from the truth. They're the Bureau of Lying Statisticians. That is what the BLS actually stands for. JALT's job openings, 12 of the last 14 job openings reports were revised lower after the fact. It's never been this systemic. Again, in the lead up to recessions, there are some, because it makes sense. If you're an economist and you're predicting something, but the economy is weakening, you're going to overshoot a little bit and then we enter a recession. But that's not what has happened this time. This time, we have persistently overshot, and it's a deliberate measure in order to convince the American public and the global investing public that all is fine, all is well. But if you're living here in America, it couldn't be further from the truth. This is the most recessionary non-recession we've ever had. GDP is technically still positive. It's negative in real terms, but it's technically still positive. And so because of that, we can say that the economy is expanding. We're doing really well. You have these news prints, these economic releases that also corroborate that we're doing well. But in real terms, GDP is negative and you can't find a job. So it's the most recessionary non-recession ever. So we're past the point of trying to actually fix these problems, and we've entered into the era of runaway fiscal spending paired with systemic propaganda at the economic data release level in order to just construct a total veneer of economic strength. Couldn't be further from reality. So that's the position we're in, and it's not going to get better. It's not going to get better. Of course, there will be better skies ahead. The economy will improve at some stage. Basically, we're in a position now where the Fed has the tools to make it so that we never experience a prolonged recession. And so we're going to continue having hot inflation so that we never do. It's a huge tangent there, but boiled down, they're lying to you. All they have left is propaganda. These things won't be fixed. And it's on all of us in order to understand the problem, understand what's going on here, and speak about it dispassionately and not be afraid to say these things. I don't know if I'll ever get hired at Bloomberg for the things that I'm tweeting out, but it's necessary because I'm trying to bring as many people to the lifeboat as possible by illustrating the problem, explaining that the people in charge have no desire to fix it, and then pointing people to the asset that will allow them to insulate themselves from all of it.
It's just quite radical, the conclusion, right? That if these trends essentially suggest that the BLS, which we look to for, I would argue, like independent, just factual data, is fudging with the numbers to some extent, right? And I mean, the data is there, the revision history is there, just for anyone to plainly see. But it's quite staggering and shocking to see that is what.
It's a huge black pill to swallow the reality that no one's coming to save you. It's a huge black pill because you and I growing up, I'm sure we thought that the government, the people in charge, they're here to work for us. They're here to tell us things straight. They're here to be honest with us. But the data, it's so staggering. It's very damning.
How about on the side of inflation, CPI? There has been, I think, a lot over the past couple of years just around picking apart CPI numbers and it maybe not being a fair representation of the quote-unquote like true inflation that's been happening. We have seen, you know, pretty hot inflation numbers recently. I'm curious to get your kind of summary on that front.
For sure. Yeah, so CPI right now, the long-run target that the Fed goes for is a range of around 2%, and it usually varies between 50 basis points under and 50 basis points over, so like 1.5% to 2.5% range that yearly price inflation fluctuates around. It's now been at 3.5% for 10 months straight, and it's less volatile than it was in the Fed's target range of 1.5 to 2.5%. And so that means it's not that we're stuck here because it's growing pains to get back to 2%. We're staying here forever, right? This is the new normal. So price inflation is now 1.5 times faster than it has been historically for the last 50 some odd years. And because its volatility is so low in this range, it leads me to believe that this is where we're going to stay. This is where we're going to stay in the long run. And also upstream surveys highlight the exact same thing. So headline price inflation, we went above the range post-COVID after all this monetary and fiscal stimulus ended up hitting consumer prices. We went from all the way from our range to 9.1%, falling back down to 3.5%. We've hung out there, and this is where we'll stay. Not just because the Fed won't allow a prolonged recession, because that hurts the U.S. and the global economic stage. It will not happen during an election year where recessions are basically banned. Okay, you can't have a recession in an election year. The incumbent will do everything in his power, including running a 50% higher fiscal deficit than was projected for this year. But also upstream prices tell me that we're not going to break below the 3% line anytime soon. Prices paid by manufacturing businesses and service businesses. There's something called the ISM survey. And it's the most universally used survey that people reference when they're trying to take a look at business activity, right? Services, businesses, upstream manufacturing. And upstream right now, both services prices and manufacturing prices, they lead CPI inflation by about 6 months. And if we overlay the two on top of one another, services prices have been rising. They've been elevated over the last several months. And they actually tell us that CPI isn't done moving back up. It's probably going to hit 4% and go above 4% once again to 4.25%. So that's where we're headed. And it's so plainly visible in the data. And as a function of that, there is a huge sell-off going on and a huge difficulty that the U.S. Treasury is having in funding itself. Okay, if you have a security that is yielding you 4%, 4.5% nominally, and price inflation is headed back up, we don't have negative yields. But when the trade-off is between like 0.5% and 1% risk-free, and just going out and investing in a cash-flowing business or investing in the S&P 500, which is ripping right now, mm-hmm. a great deal of that has to do with the fiscal situation that we're in, people don't want to own the government debt. And that's what we're seeing. The 10-year had its biggest spike in yields, third biggest since the COVID sell-off. So people are selling government bonds. They're not buying government bonds. Of course, there's still a huge appetite for that. I'm not trying to be a doomsayer, but what I am saying is that growth expectations are so hot that people aren't funding the U.S. Treasury as much as they normally do at a time when our budget has never been higher in a non-crisis environment. It's very insane. Price inflation elevated. I have a feeling it's going to stay here. It's a new normal.
I think that was the maybe insight in reading Safe's book related to the fiat standard and the Bitcoin standard that really struck me, was that anybody who wants to just save and sit on their savings are now being pushed and pushed and pushed to becoming investors and risking their capital to some extent if they want to maintain their purchasing power. And that is a very frustrating thing if you're a saver and all you want to do is just retain your purchasing power and not take any risk with it. But that is the world that we live in. To kind of close here, just on a topical note, I know the Bitcoin halving is coming up pretty soon. I'm curious, just from a price action perspective, on what you're looking at as it relates to Bitcoin and the price action in light of the fact that in the coming weeks we'll go through a Bitcoin halving, what your overall kind of perspective there is.
For sure, yeah. So given the fact that we have this no recession mandate, the Fed will step in at any sign of financial instability. The deficit is where it is. Our budget is so high for fiscal year 2025. It's a perfect macro setup for Bitcoin this year. At the same time, that Bitcoin supply schedule is going to get reduced by 50% in 8 days, it's projected. So Bitcoin supply schedule gets cut in half every 210,000 blocks. Blocks are 10-minute increments. So that works out to about 4 years between each halving. A little bit less than that. A little bit less than 4 years by about a month each time. That's the way it works out if the system's chugging along as it should be. And so historically, following following Bitcoin's halvings, we've gone on tears that are higher than 100% every single time. I will pull up the chart now because I think I have it readily handy, but
is it I won't bog down
the conversation. What we've seen is Well, it's not that it doesn't get priced in. It's just basic supply and demand dynamics, right? People know that the halving is coming, but because markets are forward discounting mechanisms, right? They know that the halving is coming, but also this is a commodity that's absolutely scarce, and so it has had a huge impact. This halving has had a huge impact on Bitcoin's price historically. If you take out the first halving, because Bitcoin was so illiquid at the time, and you just look at the last two, it rose by 370-something% during its second halving in 2016. In the year following 2016, and in the year following its third halving, it went on a it rose 360-something%. And so, even though markets are efficient, they're not perfectly efficient. Okay, we're operating on imperfect information, and so the price doesn't totally reflect these events as we would like it to. But the reality of 50% less Bitcoin coming online is reflected in the price in the year following that event happening. That's what we've seen historically, and so that I have a feeling, just judging by cycles, not just Bitcoin's own cyclicality, but where we are from a macro perspective and how great the risk appetite is right now, I think we're going to see a very similar thing post-halving, a multi-100% run for Bitcoin, in the 350% appreciation range. Just purely historically, purely using cyclicality, not factoring anything else. That's my analysis there. Markets are efficient at discounting information, but they aren't perfectly efficient. And we've seen that following Bitcoin's halvings, it goes on these tears. And so this time I have no reason to believe that that's going to be different.
Joe, I know we're coming at time. Appreciate you kind of entertaining the discussion. It's fun for me to complement some of my personal podcast and reading consumption with a conversation with somebody who's on the ground and following markets kind of on a daily basis. So I appreciate the insights. In terms of best places for people to follow along with your analysis and all that you're up to, feel free to please share with the audience.
Tyler, this was an awesome discussion, man. I really like... I like babbling. It helps me organize my thoughts in my head. So I appreciate you giving me the medium to do that, man. This was an awesome conversation. Yeah, you can find me on X at Joe Consorti, just the name as it appears in the title, first and last. I have no other accounts. So if you get a DM from somebody, I'm not inviting you to a private crypto group. There are a lot of scammers out there, especially now during the bull market. So be careful. My only account that I have is at Joe Consorti on X. And you could also follow along with the Bitcoin Layer and Theia. That's where I publish my research, at the Bitcoin Layer, just as it reads in the sign above me, if there's not too much glare, and at Theia Bitcoin. That's Theia, T-H-E-Y-A. I'm an analyst over at the Bitcoin Layer, and I'm an advisor over at Theia Bitcoin. That is where you can find those three places are where you can find all my work.
There were a lot more avenues I think we could have gone down with the discussion, but we'll have to save those for another time. Thanks so much, Joe. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Tyler.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Idea Exchange podcast. For more information on the podcast and more information about myself, you can visit tylerchow.com. I also send out a monthly newsletter to friends, family, and colleagues where I essentially share the best ideas that I came across from that month, whether it was books that I've been reading, podcasts that I've been listening to, or just conversations that I've been having. So feel free to subscribe on the homepage of my personal website. Until next time.